By this time, he had taken over Wilson's liaison chores with the Afghan lobby in Washington, in particular with the Committee for a Free Afghanistan and its much-loved director, Mary Spencer, who was constantly asking Wilson to help raise money to finance surgery for badly wounded Afghan fighters. Schnabel ended up spending an inordinate amount of time fundraising to buy tickets to fly the fighters to the United States for treatment. Soaring homeward on a McCollum flight late one night, the resourceful politico was struck by how empty the huge C-5A was. It came to him all at once. If he could put the wounded Mujahideen on these cavernous planes, he wouldn't have to raise any more money. Wilson was so intrigued with the idea that when he next visited Pakistan, he told a group of war-weary commanders that he would soon bring a plane load of wounded freedom fighters back to the States for specialized treatment. This was the beginning of a sometimes touching, sometimes ludicrous chapter in the war, in which Charlie Wilson caused America to open its arms to these exotic freedom fighters. At first, it all seemed quite wonderful. Joanne Herring came out of political retirement to join Charlie in welcoming the first load of wounded heroes to arrive in Houston. It was a dramatic event. Wounded Mujahideen in wheelchairs with their freedom hats, local Afghans cheering and noisily stamping on a Soviet flag as cameras recorded it all for the 6 o'clock news. And everywhere these Afghan martyrs were sent for medical care in those days, sympathetic stories about their cause would follow. But then the problems began. For one thing, these puritanical mountain men, with their fundamentalist Islamic ways, which required that proper Afghan women cover themselves from head to foot, weren't prepared for the virtual nudity of the American nurses. The Mujahideen were, however, just men, so one can imagine their reaction upon seeing young blonde women with much of their legs and arms and even portions of their necks and upper chests stark naked, the devil's own temptresses reaching down to touch them. This nightmarish diplomatic problem fell upon its author, Schnabel, to deal with. In most instances, he was able to smooth things over with the agitated nurses by explaining the cultural divide, but he had no idea what to say to the hospital boards once tribal war broke out in the hospital ward. The problem began with the arrival of a rather fanatical fundamentalist from Yunis Khalis's faction, the same leader who had asked Wilson for the suits of Spanish armor. The Afghan was a large man by the name of Afridi, who had a sensitive medical problem. His wife couldn't have children, and since he was a major commander and something of a mullah in his own right, he'd managed to get a McCollum flight for the two of them to revitalize her reproductive system. After a bit of investigation, Schnabel discovered that the real problem was not with Afridi's wife. According to Schnabel, Afridi didn't have any bullets in his gun, and he went through terrible psychological anguish. Apparently, he compensated by becoming aggressive toward rival tribesmen, at one point precipitating a fight that terrified the nurses. The Afghans, being Afghans, had broken up into fundamentalist and non-fundamentalist camps, as well as dividing along tribal lines, and Schnabel received a frantic call in Washington warning of an impending slaughter. By the time he arrived on the day's last flight into Dallas, they were all brandishing knives. "I hear you want to kill each other," he said. "I want you to know that you're all going back on the next plane if you don't straighten out. Now give me your knives." No one moved. The veteran political fixer then tried appealing to the common cause. "Allah loves you both," he urged, getting between them. "Allah loves you just like Allah loves you. That ought to make you feel good. He loves all of you." It was a heartfelt effort on Schnabel's behalf, but the Afghans only glared more menacingly at one another. "They argued, got mad, thrust their forefingers out at each other," recalls Schnabel. "But after this, the argument suddenly stopped and they hugged. We all hugged, you know, right side, left side, and right side again. We hugged so much that my face got scratched up by all those beards." Schnabel returned to Washington feeling a bit like a hero, quite convinced that he had pulled off a masterly reconciliation. But a few days later came another frantic late-night call from the hospital. They were at it again, and this time it was really serious. It just wouldn't do to have Charlie's boys cutting one another's throats in a distinguished Texas hospital. Clearly Wilson's reputation was on the line. In fact, the whole program for the Afghan wounded was on the line, and to a certain extent, Schnabel felt the entire war effort could be placed in jeopardy. A lesser spirit might have given up on these incorrigible tribalists, but Schnabel hadn't served as Secretary of State of the best little whorehouse in Texas for nothing, and as he flew west, he came up with a plan. The fundamentalists among the Afghans had been unhappy about their food. They couldn't eat the hospital fare because their religion demanded that animals be sanctified before slaughter. Schnabel seized on this as an opportunity to flatter and co-opt the leading troublemaker, Afridi, by turning him into the party's mullah. And so now Wilson's ever-resourceful aide found himself and the burly fundamentalist looking over a sea of chickens in the local processing plant. Afridi, with appropriate solemnity, was uttering the Allahu Akbar chant. That night the mullah seemed at peace with himself over the chicken dinner. But Afridi's troubles were deep-seated, and in no time he was back stirring the pot, telling the mujahideen that they were all entitled to 2 calls home per week, and that his personal enemy in the next ward, Rashid, was being allowed to make calls when they were not. With that, the knives came out again. Schnabel, in desperation, called Afghan's military commander in Peshawar, who warned Afridi that he was compromising the jihad. But nothing could calm this agitated Muslim, and when the McCollum flight returned him to his tribe, according to Schnabel, they hung him by his neck with a rope and took him out of his misery. The wounded program, nevertheless, proved to be stunningly effective at building goodwill in America. There were other mishaps, but the more typical experience for the hospitals and communities that took in the Afghans was the discovery of an incredibly brave and impressive people. Up until that time, the press had not paid much attention to the Afghan war, but now local news stories about the noble Afghans were appearing all over the country, wherever mujahideen were being placed for treatment. The wounded program was transforming Wilson's entire office as well. Charlie had previously kept his Afghan work all to himself, not even sharing basic details. With Schnabel enlisting everyone in the effort, however, it was as if Charlie's district lines had suddenly expanded to take in a large slice of South Asia as well. Wilson's press secretary, Elaine Lang, was planting stories about the wounded program everywhere. His aides, arguably the most effective on the Hill, with a record of getting more satisfaction from the federal government on behalf of Charlie's constituents than any other congressional office, were widening their focus to taking care of Afghanistan's wounded as well. All of the programs that Wilson was expanding or helping launch were soon taking on lives of their own. More important, they were beginning to fit into one another as if by design, even though there had been no grand architect other than the now sober and single-minded congressman. His office, meanwhile, was coming to resemble a zany Hollywood stage set as an unlikely procession of exotic figures began appearing with greater and greater frequency. Bearded mujahideen commanders, Pakistani generals, Mossad agents from Israel, Saudi princes, Egyptian arms merchants and field marshals, CIA station chiefs, division chiefs, intelligence analysts, Russian experts, demolition experts, Pentagon weapons designers. The talk was always about war, about killing Russians in a campaign thousands of miles away, a conflict that few in America seemed to know or care about. And yet, had any of this congressman's liberal colleagues known what kind of plots and vicious killing devices were being dreamed up and ordered into production during these astonishing sessions, they surely would have been horrified. The incongruity of it all struck each and every one of the visitors as they moved past the bank of tall and dramatic young Texan women in the reception area and were greeted by the beaming cowboy congressman, who acted as if he alone spoke for America when it came to Afghanistan. Down the hall and throughout the Capitol, his Democratic colleagues were noisily at war with the CIA, launching investigations, trying to shut down its secret wars in Central America. But in room 2265 of the Rayburn Building, Wilson made it seem as if America and the Democratic House and just about everyone was completely behind this effort to take on the Russians, and he calmly committed Congress to producing sums of money that no president or CIA director would ever have imagined requesting. Needless to say, it was unusual to find a Capitol Hill office dedicated almost exclusively to a CIA campaign to kill Russians in Afghanistan. And curiously, as the war unfolded, the congressman's growing role became more and more obvious as huge heroic photographs of mujahideen commanders began going up on the wall. Soon there would be a gigantic picture of the congressman himself inside Afghanistan, sitting astride a white horse, surrounded by fierce-looking freedom fighters and appearing as striking as a Hollywood movie star. The strange part about the goings-on here was that almost no one ever took these clues to his real role seriously. Almost everyone assumed that this Texas congressman was just playing out some little boy's fantasy. As Avrakatos would always marvel, it was just about as good a cover as he had ever seen.